Chapter 29. Displaced Persons Camp, 11Y, Macedonia. The young medic checked Mohammed and Amira Bakur first, treating a nasty scrape on the boy's arm with disinfectant and a clean elastic wrap. Mohammed never blinked, his jaw set to take the pain. Amira had broken her wrist, and the doctor applied a cast from just shy of her elbow to the web between her thumb and fingers. She cried, but tried not to. Jane Houri plugged her cell phone into an adapter and took her turn with the medic. He confirmed what Jane feared, that her eardrum was damaged on the right side, her hearing cut in half, and the tinnitus that had affected her on the bus drive north through Macedonia wasn't going away anytime soon. Jane also had sprained two fingers on her left hand, and the medic swapped out dirty tape for a smelly, yellow antibacterial scrub and new wrappings. She gave all three of them antibiotics. "You are mother?" The medic was Greek, and attempts to communicate with them in Greek had failed. He fell back on stunted English. "I'm British," Jane said. "I'm a journalist." "Go," the aide said, and pointed to a checkpoint 30 meters on. Jane started to rise, and the medic pushed Mohammed forward. "Go!" But this time he pointed to another checkpoint in the opposite direction.
"We need to stick together," Jane said. "I'm responsible for..."
"Go, English," the medic said, returning items to his Red Crescent backpack, casting his eyes about for the next patients. He waved vaguely to the first checkpoint, then to the second. "Go, Muslims!"
"We need to stick..." But the young medic had moved on. "What happens to us now?"
Amira asked, tears in her large brown eyes. Her face was smudged with dirt, her pretty jumper grimy. Jane pulled her into a hug. Her older brother stood vaguely apart.
"We get across the border," Jane said. "Come along."
Mohammed had added a guarded look to his worried brow.
"But you're British. We cannot..."
Jane stuffed her passport into her shoulder bag, burying it deep beneath her palm-width reporter's notebook. She took Amira's unbroken hand and half-dragged her toward the second checkpoint for the refugees. The queue was several hundred people deep and appeared not to be moving.
"Mohammed, come along!"
Once up to the checkpoint, Jane could see the gold-on-blue flag with six white stars. The flags were planted on the Kosovo side of the fence. She saw a mass of refugees along with buses and military transport units. UN officials and Greek officials began separating the Syrian refugees from all others. Jane identified herself as Jinan Houri and held the siblings close together.
"You're Syrian?"
an aid worker asked.
"We are together," she replied in Arabic.
"These children, they are Syrian?"
"Yes," Jane said.
"And you are..."
"We are together."
The flow was too much. The aid worker stamped a sheet of paper, thrust it at Jane, and waved them through. Together. The journey through the checkpoints and on to Kosovar soil took another 3 hours. Someone brought water for the refugees, and the kids drank their fill. Someone provided sandwiches and woody, tasteless apples, and Jane Houri made sure her charges got fed, then stuffed two more of the pre-wrapped sandwiches into her bag. The ringing in her ears and the dull ache from her sprained fingers made every simple movement a challenge. The sun shone down bright, and the slow-moving refugees kicked up a cloud of dust. Amira cried into her sleeve. From the way she held her right arm, she was in considerable pain. Jane rummaged through her rucksack and found the flip phone that she and Tamer had purchased, the one she'd charged in the medic's tent. It was identical to the phone they'd left with Mohammed's and Amira's parents. Jane showed it to the girl.
"When your mom and dad get through, they'll be able to reach us, okay?"
Amira nodded, eyes large and glistening behind tears.
"I need to keep this safe. I have an idea."
Jane took the slim phone and slid it into the space between the girl's cast and her skinny forearm.
"There. Your job is to keep this safe. When your mother and your father call, we'll know just where it is, okay?"
That seemed to make her smile. Jane turned to see how Mohammed was holding up. The boy was peering over his shoulder. He turned back and bent close to Jane, speaking for her ears only.
"The other checkpoints have shorter lines," the boy said. "You'd have been through by now."
Jane squeezed his shoulder.
"We'll be through soon enough." An hour later, they were in Kosovo amid more aid workers. Tents had been established, food and water were distributed, along with salt tablets and used clothes. A Red Crescent tent provided a mobile surgical hospital. It was doing a brisk business. The threesome sat under a tree and ate oranges and carrots, gulping water. Jane excused herself and stepped behind a tree to puke, but brought up only froth. As she turned back to the siblings, a handsome young man in a military uniform approached them. He crouched low and smiled.
"You're Serbians? Your family?" he asked in stilted Arabic.
"We're together," Jane replied, stepping closer, wishing the ringing in her ear would subside.
"Who are you?"
"I'm Jinia. This is Mohammed and Amira. We're together." She kept to her mantra, now fearful that her British passport would serve as a wedge between herself and the children.
"You're so young," the soldier said and smiled.
Jane knew she looked like a teenager, even when she tried to dress stylishly in London. Now, in a dirt-stained hijab, long skirt and trainers, she probably looked like she was 18.
"We've had a long journey. We have family waiting for us," she said.
The soldier said, "This lot won't get out of the camp until the day after tomorrow. I think I can get the three of you through faster. Come with me, I'll see if I can't expedite matters."
They stood. Jane Damner threw her arms around him and kissed him.
"You are too kind."
"Not at all. Give me a moment to contact my people."
He walked 15 paces away, drawing his walkie-talkie.
"It's Krasnichi. Let Major Basha know. We have a new shipment."
Chapter 30 Tours, France. Finnegan unlocked the cargo hold of the de Havilland. He found their prisoner sitting up, glowering sullenly at them. He dogged the hatch and sat on the floor. His prisoner's left wrist cuffed to the iron tie-down D-ring in the floor. He was maybe 25, Finnegan thought, and clearly a tough guy. Finnegan had brought his iPad. He sat very close to the soldier, within striking distance. That term goes both ways. The soldier leaned a bit to his right, away from Finnegan. He said something in a Slavic language. "Do your worst," Finnegan figured, or some such cliché. Finnegan set the iPad on an inverted box of photocopier sheets. The de Havilland served as a flying office, with all the accoutrements, and activated the video player. He sat back against the fuselage, cross-legged, eyes on the screen. It showed a France 24 video of the arrests in Amboise. The news presenter bubbled excitedly about drugs and guns and organized crime. The editors had spliced together images of flashing red and blue dome lights and the pistols dusted in cocaine and the Kosovar soldiers, handcuffed, hunched and humbled, doing the perp walk to an armored paddy wagon in the scenic old town. The next video was an Al Jazeera report on the same arrests. Finnegan pointed to the screen, to the automatic weapons and their light dusting of narcotics, and shook his head.
"Cocaine. You know that word? Cocaine? We got it from Guy Lacazette. Fucker brought a dime bag to the hit. Can you believe this guy?"
He shook his head in wonder. Finnegan hadn't known whether the soldier spoke English, but now he knew, from the way the guy's body language reacted to that little speech. The video switched to a Reuters report on the arrests. Finnegan reached out to lower the audio. He leaned back against the curved surface of the fuselage and ran a palm over his stubble. 5 minutes passed. The videos, on a loop, returned to France 24. The soldier spat on the floor.
"Fuck you, I tell you nothing."
Now Fierro knew that the kid spoke English, too. She stood with Lachlan Sumner, on the far side of the aft hatch, listening via the Skype function on the iPad. Finnegan said,
"It's simple. You guys are kidnapping little kids, Muslim kids, and selling them to perverts. You know that word, pervert?"
The soldier lacked even a rudimentary poker face. Of course he knew the word. He'd absently moved his right hand to brace his left flank, where Fierro had hit him with a taser the night before.
"We want this little bitch, Lazar Aleksich. He's a snot, a fucking stain on humanity. The World Court already has his number. It's, I don't know, a day, a week, till they put this asshole away." "Go to Hall, you American bastard."
The soldier tried to growl the insult, but his tone was flecked with self-pity, and not a little pain. Plus, he hadn't peed in about a dozen hours, so that was bothering him.
He sounded more defensive than angry, playing not to lose too badly rather than playing to win. Finnegan said, "Hell. Go to hell." The soldier tried spitting on the deck again. "We do not care about the Kosovo security force." Finnegan stopped, gave it a beat, then repeated it with the exact same cadence and inflections. "We do not care about the Kosovo security force. You're an army. Do I look like an army? Me and Signora Falcone, we're cops. We arrest crooks like Aleksic. We don't arrest armies. What, we look stupid to you? Something about us leads you to think we're naive? I'm like a babe in the woods?" He nudged the kid, elbow to elbow. "Huh?" Despite himself, the soldier shook his head, just a little. Likely he was totally unaware of the gesture. But he'd entered the dialogue now. "Armies do terrible things, but cops don't arrest armies. It never happens, not in the real world. Police arrest dumb shits like Lazar Aleksic. He's who we want, you understand?"
"Go to hell."
"Better. Short E. Listen, here's the thing. You've got no ID, no money, no comms, no weapons. The French police are looking for you. I've given them your photo. When you get out of here, you're going to want to get back to Kosovo. I get that. But if you don't get arrested, can you imagine the greeting you get when you stroll in on Major Basha?" The kid flinched at the name Basha. "Think about what I'm saying. Help me put the dumb shit in prison, and I'll owe you one. I can get you out of France. No muss, no fuss. Don't help me, and you've got to walk the length and width of Europe to get back to the base, from which you are absent without leave. It'll take you weeks. I'll still arrest the dumb shit, but now it'll happen after you show up, out of the clear blue. What's Major Basha going to think about that, huh? Think he'll be suspicious? Think he'll kiss you on both cheeks and give you a promotion?" Finnegan sat forward and set aside the iPad. He untucked the four flaps of the photocopy paperback and reached in, withdrawing a cheap flip phone. "Know what this is?" The soldier frowned.
"His phone."
"Right. This is programmed with my number and my number only. You can reach me anytime. Help me out, I get you out of France, free of charge." He slid it into the soldier's breast pocket. Finnegan reached into the box again. "Know what this is?"
"His taser."
"Right," Finnegan said. Then he tucked the tines under the kid's lowest rib and fired. They left the unconscious soldier sprawled out on the same motel bed they'd slept in the night before. Lachlan got the de Havilland revved up, and they were airborne long before the Kosovar awoke. Chapter 31. European Airspace. While Lachlan Sumner flew south and east toward the Adriatic, the partners sat in two of the four bolted-down club chairs, circled around a low plastic table, and ate sandwiches and bags of chips and drank wine from a pouch. A soldier and a cop. They were well used to eating prepackaged food with plastic utensils. Finnegan took food and bottled water up to Lachlan, then returned to his own lunch. While they ate, he made a call to old friends and arranged for 24/7 surveillance of Lazar Aleksic and the Ragusa Logistics Building in Belgrade. As he hung up, Fiera wiped her lips with a paper napkin and said, "De Blackhearts?"
"Who better?"
St. Nicholas Salvage and Wrecking could subcontract out with a detective agency, presumably, but most such agencies are required to follow very specific laws in regards to their work. The Blackhearts, a nickname culled from a pub they call home, were thieves. The arrangement was simple. St. Nicholas occasionally asked the Hearts to help when personnel were required, and the Hearts helped themselves to stealing anything that didn't directly interfere with the mission. But relying on the Black Hearts was similar to relying on Brody McTavish and his mercenaries. Thieves, like mercenaries, went where the profit was. You could rent their loyalty, but you couldn't own it. She sipped her wine. It wasn't terribly good, and, being a Spaniard, Fierro could tell the difference. She knew Finnegan couldn't.
"This Basha. He sent men to do a job, and they failed. Spectacularly. Public arrests, the guns, the cocaine you found on Lacazette."
She licked mustard off the pad of her thumb.
"He lost personnel. He lost a head-to-head matchup with an opponent. He lost face."
"If he's figured out who we are, and he clearly has,
Viara reached for the intercom on the wall and toggled it. Lachlan?
Go,
the laconic Kiwi drawled from the flight deck.
Have Bridget clear out of Kyrenia for a while. It's possible these people know.
Did it last night? The pilot interrupted. I figured the same. She's checked into the Samele in Nicosia.
Good thinking. Thank you.
She toggled the switch off and sat back. She selected a single potato chip from Finnegan's bag. She'd finished her own.
We have to shift focus. We need to work on Drayton Basha.
We're getting paid to take down Aleksich.
Aleksich is a posturing adolescent. It's unlikely he'll kill any refugees currently in the pipeline, or who were recently sold in order to cover his tracks. I'm afraid Major Basha will.
Finnegan poured a little more wine from the metallic sack into their plastic glasses. The soldier kid we grabbed. He might help with that.
Possible.
So how you want to play this?
Throw a spanner in the works. See what happens.
That might endanger the victims.
Doing nothing might endanger the victims.
Is Basha expecting us to come at him?
Not directly, I think.
She favored her partner with a frosty smile.
He'll assume his soldiers failed in the field. He'll credit the outcome with their incompetence. He won't credit us for outfighting them.
And he won't expect us to go on offense now.
So is that what we do? Go on offense? Fierro's smile grew frostier. Chapter 32. Kosovo Security Force Operating Base Shar. Major Drayton Basha stood in his quarters with a glass of vodka in one hand and the TV remote in the other, watching Sky News, aghast. Unbelievable. One of his chief aides, Captain Stevan Sorak, handcuffed and scowling at the cameras as he was led from an armored van to a prison outside Paris. Four good men with him, one man missing. The arrested men facing charges after being found with guns and cocaine? Basha had a fairly good sense for which of his men were fuck-ups and which weren't. The men he'd sent to France were as good as any he had. There was no possibility of the operation accidentally becoming a drug buy gone wrong. No, this was a message. It was a message directed at Basha himself. The bounty hunters with a stupid company name. They were sending a very loud, very public fuck you to Drayton Basha. He drained his glass, eyes locked on the screen.
If it's a war they want.
Chapter 33. Belgrade. Lazar Aleksich had gone through stages of reaction after witnessing the murder of the girl he'd brought back from the club. He had stood in the far corner of his penthouse living room as Kosovar soldiers brought up a body bag to dispose of the girl, who still wore Lazar's T-shirt. She'd bled under the coffee table, but not as much as he'd expected from someone stabbed in the heart by what amounts to an ice pick. Lazar experienced pure, unalloyed horror at the sight of the murder. He'd vomited and more. A very large part of his conscious mind focused on the cadaver, the girl he'd picked up, the girl he'd screwed, while a smaller but important part of his conscious mind focused on his relief that the soldiers didn't realize he'd soiled himself. After the horror came the slow, insane certainty that he and Major Basha would both be arrested for the murder. So very many people had seen Lazar with the girl, what the hell was her name, the night before. They'd seen her leave with him. How could they not? Her in her scarlet dress and acrylic platform shoes and improbable breasts. The witness list for the murder trial would go on for days. The day continued and was followed by night, and so very, very much marijuana and coke and vodka and whiskey, which was followed by morning, and no police ever showed up. Of course, the badly hungover Lazar Aleksich realized his newfound friends in the Kosovo Security Force had created a bubble of reality for him, based on the profits his enterprise was generating. They had the product, he had the buyers, and the European distribution system, and together they had turned over a few million dollars in less than 2 years, with no end in sight. As such, he lived in a cocoon of an alternative reality constructed and controlled by Major Basha. And even before Basha, Lazar had purchased the controlling rights to the inspector who ran Belgrade's major crimes unit. The police kept well clear of Lazar's business, and the top brass were well paid for that. Lazar played the moment over and over and over and over in his mind. The girl, the look in her eye, the ice pick, the cool assuredness of Dryden Basha, the slow-blooming circle of blood on that old T-shirt. He had loved that T-shirt. And after another day had turned into another night, turned into another morning, and after shot of liquor with coke, with ecstasy, Lazar Aleksic had finally reached a final stage of reaction. He wanted to try it. He wanted to see if he could do what Basha had done, as coolly. He told one of the Kosovar guards that he wanted a girl. Someone who could go missing. Chapter 34. Tour. The young Kosovar corporal, his name was Aegon Yumnica, awoke in his strange hotel room. He'd been hit 3 times with the taser and his gut ached. He rolled out of the bed and limped to the window, spotting a sunny day and a grassy slope and a curving river that he thought likely to be the same one he'd been seeing since arriving. The Loire. He remembered sitting in the bakery truck, listening over his headset as chaos erupted inside the cottage. He remembered calling to Captain Sorak, or to anyone on the team. Then the driver's door had been ripped open and the tall, black-haired woman appeared, as if from out of the mist. He remembered waking up in a storage hold, handcuffed to the floor. He could feel the floor rocking and decided that they had him on some sort of barge on the river. The American bastard had come in and showed him the video of Captain Sorak's team being arrested and charged with drug dealing? Was that possible? Just barely. The truth was, the major had first crossed paths with the blonde party boy in Belgrade because the unit's own drug dealings intersected with his own. The unit had been making good money on the side, selling cocaine and heroin imported up through Greece, until the wars in the Middle East interrupted that supply chain. Rather than panic, Major Basha had found a new and decidedly more profitable merchandise to sell, and Aleksic had provided the transportation and the clients. The unit still moved a considerable amount of cocaine, but it was an enterprise with some risks. With drugs, the unit had to rely on Chinese, Thai, or, worst of all, Mexicans for their supply. With refugees, the supply walked up to the door, knocked, and asked to come in. In this case, however, no, that wasn't what had happened here in France. Captain Sorak's team surely would have been happy dealing a bit of drugs on the side, but if so, the entire team would have been in on it. No, the soldier told himself, this has to be a trick by that American fucker and the tall Spanish bitch. Yumnica reached into his shirt pocket and withdrew the cheap flip phone. This is programmed with my number. You can reach me any time. Help me out. I get you out of France free of charge. Yumnica washed up in the hotel bathroom, then snuck out into the parking lot. He marched to the highway and hitched a ride with some German tourist kids to an air de service, one of the Shell Oil-affiliated motorway service areas that dot France's auto routes. He waited until a lone businessman was washing his car, far from the dining crowd and the laughing children on the outdoor playset. Yumnica simply walked up to the businessman and plowed his fist into the man's stomach. The pudgy man folded like a Swiss Army knife. He took the man's wallet and keys and, why not, his watch and wedding ring. Then he called headquarters. He reported to his staff sergeant, who was in on Major Basha's cabal, exactly what had happened. The staff sergeant told the first sergeant, who told Lieutenant Akhil Krasnichi, who reported up the ranks to Major Basha himself. They arranged for Corporal Aegon Yumnica to get to Le Mans Arnage Airport, where a Ryanair ticket to Belgrade awaited him. He palmed the cheap phone throughout the flight, deep red murderous thoughts sloshing through his brain. The American has assumed that he, Aegon Yumnica, would be disloyal, that he'd be easy to flip. He would see. He most definitely would see. Chapter 35. Kosovo. An olive-covered truck with military stencils and a canvas roof over a metallic ribcage took 19 of the refugee youths north toward Europe. Jane Houri, who looked like a teenager, huddled with Mohammed and Amira Bakur in the back, one arm around each. A fatigue overcame Mohammed, who slept almost the entire trip. Amira held her broken right wrist tight against her torso. She made herself small as she could and absently played with the hem of Jane's keffiyeh. The humming in Jane's ear had subsided a bit. It felt surreal, hearing the whoosh of fresh pavement under the tires and the sound of regular traffic on the highway. No more traveling by foot on sand and dirt. From time to time, wisps of loud music slipstreamed past her, surfing a Doppler curve. If Jane closed her eyes and ignored the thrumming in her ear, she could imagine driving the M20 to Dover. Not all of the children were from Syria. Some were very dark, and Jane guessed they had escaped sub-Saharan Africa. Before he fell asleep, Muhammad pointed to a clique of very tired children in very dirty clothes and said, simply, "Afghan." Whether the 15-year-old knew or was guessing, Jane couldn't tell. She too slept part of the way, stirring as the truck veered off the highway. She felt a terrible crick in her neck, and her right arm, locked tight around Amira, had fallen asleep. Without waking the girl, she used her shoulder to wipe tears off her cheek. She'd been dreaming of Tamer Awad, of his camera bag and lenses and corny jokes. Muhammad awoke and twisted around. The canvas top of the truck was battened down to the metal sides at iron grommets. He lifted the canvas between two grommets, creating a thin vertical slit of bright light.
"Where are we?"
The boy was quiet for a time. The tires plowed into great potholes and crawled back out.
"It's army," the boy said. "I think."
Amira was awake now, and Jane unwound her arm from the girl's skinny shoulders. She tried not to groan like an old lady as she got around, onto her knees, and bent low to peer through the horizontal gap that Muhammad had created by holding up the canvas. Their truck approached a long, high fence topped with razor wire, a gatehouse, and a long red-and-white striped barrier arm on a counter lever. A guard with a machine gun, wearing newish fatigues and a black beret, strolled out of the guardhouse as the truck ground to a halt. Jane looked for signs indicating the Red Cross or Red Crescent or the United Nations. She saw none. The blue-on-white sign over the barrier arm, in some Slavic script, but also in English, read, "Kosovo Security Force, Operating Base Shar." The 19 young people were ushered out of the back of the military truck. They were uniformly tired, dusty, scared, and quiet. Jane saw no aid workers and no media. Every adult within sight wore fatigues and berets, and all wore firearms on their hips. Some also carried machine guns. Guards herded the refugees into a long, brown-and-white, one-story wooden building. A large Arabic numeral 3 had been stenciled beside the door. Jane saw two identical buildings to her left and two more to her right, and the nearer was stenciled 2. Inside, the building featured a large room with rows of army cots, each with one pillow and a coarse brown blanket. A room off to the right, behind open double doors, showed cafeteria-style tables with benches. Doors off to the left appeared to lead to toilets. The 19 refugees were ushered by unsmiling soldiers into the cafeteria room. A large green plastic tray with pre-wrapped sandwiches sat on the nearest table. Jane recognized the tray as the kind used to slide dishes into an industrial dishwasher. Towers of upside-down plastic glasses stood next to the green tray.
"Arabic, Greek," a guard chanted as the kids walked into the cafeteria. "English, Arabic."
Jane thought back to the aid worker in Macedonia who had tried to separate her from the Bakur siblings because she carried a British passport.
"English," the guard said as she entered, but she kept her head down and averted her eyes.
Muhammad watched her, and Jane gave him the most tentative little head shake. When all of the refugees were in the dingy hall, a soldier put two fingers between his lips and whistled shrilly.
"Listen," he spoke Arabic. "You are staying in the barracks. Toilets are that way. Water is from the sink over there. You are not to leave the barracks. Is that understood?"
Jane, who stood near the tough plastic dishwasher tray of sandwiches, raised a tentative hand.
"What is it?"
She replied in Arabic.
"There are 19 of us. There are, a dozen sandwiches."
The soldier shrugged.
"We'll get more, I'm sure. No one leaves the barracks. People caught outside the barracks will be considered spies and will be shot."
Several of the younger children began crying. The soldiers marched out. Some of the older kids began scooping up the sandwiches. Even in times of horror, people who have known hunger will grab for food.
Jane snagged one, which she planned to split between the Bakur kids until more food arrived. Muhammad grabbed one of the upside-down glasses as they made their way to the queue in front of the kitchen sink. Jane heard the telltale sound of the barracks door being locked.
Chapter 36. Zagreb.
Finnegan and Fierro met Shan Grayson at the apartment they'd turned into a makeshift operation command over a bookstore on Avenue Petra Bereslavica. The shadow diplomat stepped into the walk-up and immediately looked like he'd been born to the place, tossing his jacket over a dining room chair and slouching against the refrigerator that formed a de facto wall separating the kitchenette from the living room from the foyer. Finnegan had a flash illusion that the floral mid-70s wallpaper perfectly matched the pattern in Shan's tie. "How goes the good fight?" he drawled. Finnegan stood in the kitchenette, breaking eggs one by one into a mixing bowl, a towel thrown over his shoulder. Fierro sat sideways on the couch in yoga leggings and a stretched-out Gypsy King's T-shirt, her legs straight and crossed at the ankles. She draped a bath towel over the room's coffee table and had broken down a P226 SIG Sauer to its component parts, laid neatly on the towel along with a rag, wire brushes, and solvent. The bits of gun lay on the table in more or less geographic proximity to where they would be in a fully formed gun, like the bits and bones of a paleo hominid in a museum case. Finnegan threw away the eggshells. "Well, Alexic is the link to organized crime in Europe. He's also the distribution. The Kosovo Security Force provides the victims and also the muscle." "Or more precisely," Fierro broke in, running a thin brush through the disconnected barrel of the firearm, "a specific unit of the KSF, run by a Major Triton Basha. He used to be linked to Serbian right-wing death squads after the Yugoslav Civil War." Finnegan said, "Basha got promoted from being an asshole for a cause to being an asshole for a paycheck." Shan didn't even bother pretending he wasn't studying Fierro's long legs and tanned feet, or the curve of her shoulder where it emerged from the frayed collar. "Can you connect Alexic the Younger with his victims?" "Not yet," Finnegan nodded toward the cabinet over the sink behind him. "You want breakfast?" "Famished," Shan rolled up his sleeves and set about collecting all three plates from the cabinet, along with three forks and both knives and squares of quilted paper towel off the roll by the sink. "So once upon a time," the Englishman murmured as he dithered about, "a junior attorney for the International Monetary Fund moved his family to Amsterdam in pursuit of his career. Said family included a 16-year-old daughter, who fancied herself something of a victim in this move, bereft as she was of her friends and her favorite mall back home in Georgia." Finnegan used a fork to froth the eggs, then poured them into a chipped pan. He turned and drew a plastic bag filled with bread from a cabinet. Shan said, "What's this?" "Big treat. I had a cousin ship it in from New York. You'll love it." Shan studied the polka dot wrapping on the loaf. "Wonder bread?" "Infinitely better than that baguette stuff you get here. Crazy. Buy a loaf in the morning, it's stale by noon. Who designed that? Wait and see. This stuff's great." He popped two spongy slices into the toaster. Fierro kept her attention on the internal workings of the SIG. Shan returned to his tale. "So anyway, the daughter decided to dress all in black, no offense, Catelyn, my sweet, and to lurk in coffee shops, writing poetry and inscribing to future generations her suffering. She bought a second-hand Nikon with a zoom lens and fancied herself an artist. She read, as God is my witness, Kafka." He shuddered. Finnegan stirred the eggs with the flat underside of the fork. "Then one day, the daughter of the junior attorney for the International Monetary Fund stumbled upon yet another urchin whose life was actually sad, as opposed to artfully sad. The girl started talking. The newcomer to this tale, whose name was Daisy, was a source of fascination for the young daughter, in that she wore a plaid microskirt and acrylic platform heels and a white blouse tied off above her midriff." Fierro glanced up from her cleaning supplies. "Rather than become fast friends after that first sharing of overpriced coffee and angst, Daisy's reaction was somewhat different. She slit her wrists." The toast popped. Finnegan plucked out both and slid in two more, then swiveled back to the eggs. Shan eyed the white bread nervously. "Ah, interesting. You're sure about—" "Dude, read this. What's it say?"
Shan peered at the packaging. Helps build strong bodies 12 ways.
Right, and in the States, they couldn't say it if it wasn't true.
Shan let it go.
Anyway, the junior attorney for the International Monetary Fund and his beloved daughter heard about the suicide attempt and dashed to the hospital. Daisy survived, and the surprises were as follows. Daisy was not Daisy at all, but Fatima. Daisy, the teenager, wasn't a teenager at all, but 12 going on 40. Daisy, the exotic, anorexic beauty, wasn't whiling away her time in a coffee shop reading Kafka. She was escaping a series of horrific sex crimes that no sane human should or even could imagine.
Finnegan said, "Sit." Fierro unwound herself from the couch and disappeared to the bathroom to wash her hands. Shan Grayson poured coffee in three mismatched mugs and distributed them, along with a carton of milk and a half-empty box of sugar. Finnegan split the eggs three ways onto plates.
"You found the attorney, or the attorney found you?"
"Friend of a friend. I heard this tale and introduced myself to Daisy turned Fatima, whence I learned several things. She was from Aleppo. She'd been separated from her family somewhere around Greece. She described Alexich the Younger to a T, although she never heard his name. I showed her a picture of him, and she was too frightened to properly identify him. Anyway, she'd been sold to a businessman who should die with festering boils. Or better yet, should live with festering boils. I also believe that the incident in the canal was her first suicide attempt, but not likely her last."
They dug in. Finnegan said, "We've got Alexich under surveillance."
"Who's watching him?"
"Don't ask. Alexich lives in a secure penthouse suite in Belgrade, under 24/7 security from the KSF. He parties in nightclubs, but always with an armed escort. So far, he's kept a clean distance between himself and his victims."
"Well, he needs to be stopped," Shan said, his eyes on his breakfast.
Fierro said, "Stopped. Just that, and kept eating."
They ate in silence, listening to the Zagreb traffic and the laughter of tourists. Until the penny dropped. Finnegan sat bolt upright, his fork halfway to his mouth, eyes going wide. He set down the fork, loaded with a mound of scrambled egg. He made the T for timeout symbol with both hands.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa, whoa!"
Fierro smiled up at him. She'd wondered how long it would take.
"Stopped? He needs to be stopped?"
"That," drawled Shan, "would be my vote. Fatima's too, I suspect."
"And Judge Betancourt?"
Shan shrugged. "She is pure of heart, Michael. You know that." Fierro set her knife and fork down on her empty plate, crossing them like the bones on a pirate flag. Finnegan studied the Englishman, then his partner, then the Englishman. He said,
"We're not assassins,"
Fierro said quietly.
"I have been."
"Yeah, but we're not. We're getting paid to get the evidence that leads to a conviction. We're getting paid to get that worthless shithead into custody, then into a courtroom."
Shan said,
"Bounty hunting in Europe is illegal."
"We know that.
But that won't stop me from making sure you get paid, fair and square, should you be successful."
Finnegan studied him. "Meaning what?
Assassination's illegal, but we get paid anyway? You're equating the two?"
Finnegan wiped his lips on a paper napkin and brushed back his chair.
His breakfast was half finished. He stood.
"I'm going for a walk. You," he pointed to Fierro. "Contact the Harts. Tell him we need to get into that penthouse. Contact McTavish. Tell him to get his ass up here."
Finnegan collected his jacket and sunglasses and stormed toward the door.
"You," he said to Shan Grayson. "Dishes."
That night, Finnegan lay in bed, one arm behind his pillow, finishing the Elmore Leonard. Fierro tapped twice and slid the door open enough to peer in. He looked at her over the top of the pages.
"Hey."
She stood with her weight on one leg, shoulder against the jamb. She wore a long T-shirt that clung to the pronounced muscles in her shoulders and her long, straight torso.
"Is your father in trouble?"
Finnegan said.
"I think maybe, yeah."
"Can you help him?"
"Probably not."
"You're not him, you know. You're not a good cop gone bad."
Finnegan didn't respond.
"We work outside the law, but we're doing good for all that."
He shrugged.
"Sure. He lay there, staring at her. And she stood there, hip-cocked, staring at him. Finnegan said, "We're not assassinating this jackass." Fierro said, "Certainly hope not." And closed the door. Chapter 37. Kosovo Security Force Operating Base, Shar. They flew Corporal Agon Yumnica directly to Pristina, where an MP with the personality of a brick met him by a Humvee and whisked him south and east from the city to the isolated operating base that served as HQ for Major Basha's unit. Lieutenant Akil Krasnichi debriefed him and made Yumnica tell the story three times: the ambush in Amboise, France, the assistance of the corrupt French private investigator, the cottage selected for its strategic value, the 6-on-2 odds, and the moment Yumnica woke up in some kind of barge on the river with the American they'd earlier identified as Michael Patrick Finnegan. When he finished the story, Lieutenant Krasnichi stared at the young corporal for a full 60 seconds. "Explain it to me again." Yumnica did. "He gave me this." Yumnica held up the disposable flip phone, the kind available at a few 100,000 shops throughout Europe. "Said it could call his number. He expected me to betray the unit." "And did you?" Krasnichi scowled at the youth, although there were only 18 months difference in their ages, and took a step closer. "You're not in some fucking cell in France, correct? Captain Sorak is. The rest of the team is." "I can't explain that." The corporal stood at attention, sweaty palms flat against his thighs, back razor straight. "The bastards took me, hit me with a taser 3 times. They expected me to show me." Yumnica drew up his shirt and undershirt and showed the lieutenant the vampire bite marks on his left side and those on his right. They were inflamed and swollen. "And you didn't talk?" Yumnica's discipline broke. "I didn't tell them fuck all, Akil." Krasnichi took another step into the young corporal's personal space. "I didn't tell them fuck all, sir. I didn't." Krasnichi took the flip phone and checked its memory. One phone number was registered, an international number. He noted 0 outgoing calls. He chewed over the tale and decided it was too unlikely to make a plausible lie. Besides, Krasnichi imagined himself a good judge of his own soldiers. Agon Yumnica was a solid enough fighter, but nobody's version of a creative genius. "All right, go get some food. The major went north to talk to the little blonde asshole. I just got back from the refugee checkpoint on the Macedonian border." He bunched his fingertips, touched them to his lips, and kissed them away. "Some lovely fruit, Agon. They are falling off the trees, and there's nobody but us to pick them." The corporal relaxed, feeling the tension bleed from his bones. "Yes, sir." "Get some rest today. 0800 tomorrow. Requisition a truck from the motor pool. Talk to none but Ristich. Get the keys from him and him alone. You understand?"
"Sir!"
"I have the product in Barracks 3. We'll gather them at 8 and drive them to Belgrade. Understood?"
"Sir!"
The corporal saluted and turned smartly on his heels. "And Agon, we get one chance to fuck up in this unit. Maybe you fucked up in France. Maybe you didn't. But don't let me down." Chapter 38. Amsterdam. Shan Grayson felt his phone vibrate. He'd arrived back from Zagreb less than 40 minutes before, and now was speaking to a trade commissioner from Finland, nodding occasionally, making the appropriate hmm noises. Shan had no earthly idea what the topic was, but no doubt the apple-cheeked youth was passionate about it. As Madame Betancourt's unofficial minister without portfolio, Shan often found himself deep in conversations that he neither understood nor cared about. That way, people could go back to their bosses or their constituents or their lovers and tell them, "Say what you will, at least the judge heard me out." The call was from the executive assistant to Milos Aleksic, director for the Levant Crisis Group of the UN High Commission for Refugees. The assistant informed him that Director Aleksic wished to speak to him on a matter of some importance as soon as possible. "Would it be possible for you to stop by the director's home tonight, Mr. Grayson, perhaps for a quick drink?" "Of course. When and where?" But with a ping, a calendar item with time and address appeared, as if by magic, on his cell phone. "Please tell the director it will be my pleasure."
Chapter 39. Sarajevo, Bosnia and Herzegovina. Finnegan and Fierro flew into the shabby little airport at Sarajevo, made famous 2 decades earlier as an easy target for Serbian death squads, who could sit in the hills with rocket-propelled grenades and wait patiently for easy-picking incoming flights. Bridget Sumner used Airbnb to find them a farmhouse outside of the city. The place looked run down enough and isolated enough that they needn't worry about snooping neighbors. Bridget herself was hiding in the resort town of Paphos, on the far western edge of Cyprus, and among the expat Russian Petro Luminati, but she had a laptop and a high-speed connection, which meant she could whistle up whatever the team needed, whenever they needed it, from the comfort of a chaise lounge working on her tan. The Scots mercenary, Brody McTavish, brought 2 men with whom the partners had worked before and 1 they hadn't. The newcomer was an Italian, wiry, sunburned, and stoic, with a crew cut and a tattoo of Venus on a half-shell filling the inside of his right forearm. "This is Bianchi," the big Scotsman boomed, once everyone was safely ensconced in the old farmhouse. "He speaks Serbian, which, I'm told, is what most of the soldiers in the KSF speak. Bianchi, this here is Catalan. She's the shot caller on this thing. You follow?" The Italian nodded in her general direction, but didn't make eye contact. Finnegan studied the newcomer, thinking possibly he was just shy, or maybe he just didn't like the idea of a woman issuing the orders. Finnegan decided it was the latter. Fierro stood a bit apart, as was her poker player's preference. She dressed in black and leather and was wearing her sunglasses, arms folded under her breasts, leaning against a rough-hewn wall with the sole of 1 boot against the rough pine, her knee thrust forward. Exactly the same body language and wardrobe as the day Finnegan met her in Crimea. McTavish continued the introductions. "This is Michael Finnegan. He's a civilian, and he's a cop, and he's a taxpayer, which makes him an honest man. Pay him no heed if he starts to pontificate regarding the sanctity of human life. But if he spots trouble, stop, drop, and roll. Do you follow me?" Again, the Italian just nodded a bit to his left, more or less toward Finnegan. The Scotsman turned to the partners, fixing both of them, 1 at a time, with a serious eye. "Bianchi's done a few jobs with me. He's fine in a fight." That was good enough for the partners. Fine in a fight being the highest praise possible from Brody McTavish. The other two, they knew. Lo Kwan was a tough little fighter from Hong Kong, who liked knives for close-up work and explosives for the rest. After 1 memorable job, he also had gotten flamingly drunk in an Egyptian bar and ended up dancing the night away with Fierro, who towered over him. Lo, it turned out, was an outstanding ballroom dancer. Fekadu, an Ethiopian, was a sniper. He liked long-distance work and had the vision, daylight or night, of a falcon. He didn't talk much to Finnegan, but he'd spent a couple of long-haul flights in unregistered Hercules aircraft, quizzing Catalan Fierro Dahar about her mother's religion and her own lack of faith. He had purchased a copy of the Quran for her after 1 particularly fierce firefight in Oslo. Fierro put up with it because a good sniper is worth his weight in guilt. Finnegan recovered slowly from the bear hug he'd received from Brody McTavish, then asked how the hell he'd gotten a team together so fast. Fierro had called him only 24 hours earlier. "The surveyors we was escorting around Sudan turned out to be pussies, them." McTavish hawked up a gob and spat it into the cold fireplace. "They heard a single gunshot, 1/4 kilometer from a base camp. Some fucker firing straight into the air. And what did they do? Pissed themselves and demanded we return them to Djibouti Toot Suite. It was babysitting duty anyhow. Only so much backgammon I can play with Lo Kwan before I want to pitch his fucking head off." Finnegan said. "How do you know it was some fucker firing straight into the air and not trouble?" McTavish belched a laugh. "'Cause the fucker was me, wasn't it? Scared off the punters. Let us take a real job instead, and here we are." Finnegan and Fierro exchanged smiles. Finnegan distributed coffee and sandwiches for everyone, then showed them the stack of photocopies he'd brought. "A unit of the Kosovo Security Force is kidnapping Syrian refugees coming up to the Greek corridor. They take children and sell them, either to brothels or to private buyers. They work out of this joint." He distributed aerial photos of KSF Operating Base Shar, kidney-shaped and bisected by its single road, which curved around a few buildings. To the east of the road, 5 white, 1-story barrack buildings stood end-to-end, along with a 2-story admin building.
To the west of the road, they could see the exercise yard, shooting range, heliport, garage, and the combination PX and communications radar. Finnegan had the layout memorized by now. Major Drayton Bosch's unit has the run of the place, and they're only 30 guys deep, Finnegan said.
They sleep here.
Piero stepped away from the wall and pointed to the first two of the five barrack buildings.
Buildings 4 and 5 appear to be empty. From what we can tell, someone's staying in building 3, and food gets delivered.
Lo Kwan picked up one of the photocopies.
These aren't Google Earth. These are U.S. MilSat images.
We have an employee who can get her hands on anything. Finnegan made it sound like no big deal, but to be honest, he and Fierro also had been stunned by the images Bridget Sumner had scrounged up for them. Bianchi sipped his coffee.
U.S. military satellite images. Are you CIA?
Finnegan said.
Do we look like CIA?
The Italian sighed into his cup.
They never do.
They're not, McTavish slapped the man on the shoulder. St. Nicholas is old mates, I know him. Bianchi looked confused.
Which one's St. Nicholas?
Finnegan said.
Long story.
He turned back to the photo splayed around the kitchen table. He picked one out, a grainy, distant shot of a man with gray hair clipped close to his skull, with a bull's neck and a bony jaw. This is Drayton Bosch, Major Kosovo Security Force. He's in charge. Finnegan pointed to another of the satellite photos. This is his base. It's 40 miles from Pristina, and 140 miles from the next regular army base. Becado, the Ethiopian, scratched his head.
How do you know the traffickers are here?
We grabbed one of these schmucks in France 2 days ago. He led us here. McTavish said,
how?
Tracker and a phone I gave him, another tracker sewn into the hem of his jacket. The phone's also jinxed to send audio signals, even when nobody's making a call. The guy we released is there.
As well as victims, Fierro added.
Yeah, we taped a conversation we got off the phone. Our office manager had it translated. They just got a supply of victims from the Macedonian border. The kids were transported up here, probably in Barracks 3, right in the middle of the camp here. They'll be moved out by truck at 8 a.m. tomorrow. Destination, Belgrade. McTavish checked his diver's watch. It was going on 5 p.m. local time.
Tight.
Fierro nodded from behind her opaque sunglasses. Picado pointed to one of the high-res photocopies.
Easier to hit the truck when it gets away from the camp?
Don't think so, Finnegan pointed as well. They get out of camp, and 2 minutes later they're on a heavily congested highway to Serbia. It's filled with military and civilian vehicles. It'd be a nightmare. It also puts too many civilians in the crosshairs. The quiet Italian gave a small shrug. The partners ignored him. Here's the tough part, Finnegan said. We want to separate the Vicks from the soldiers at the base camp, but we don't want them to warn their CO, Major Bosch, who's up in Belgrade with the guy who runs the organized crime end of this thing. Lo Kwan cast him a scowl.
No time for reconnaissance. Outmanned, outgunned, on their home turf. And you want it done quiet?
Fierro said.
Well, initially we wanted a team that could pull this off poorly and loudly, but they were busy. We had to settle for you.
McTavish howled with laughter. Bianchi scowled. McTavish noticed and tapped him on the shoulder.
For you ask, lad, St. Nicholas has paid the freight, in full. Plus bonus money for taking on a feckin' army base, thank you very much. So that's that, and that's all that's that. You follow? What's left is the deed itself. Then it's rum and true religion.
Picado said.
Rules of engagement?
Fierro spoke, again from outside the cluster, with her eyes hidden by the shades, her shoulders and the sole of one boot against the wall.
This lot signed on to be soldiers for their country, and instead are making a fortune selling children and selling them to monsters. They called a tune. They don't get to be picky about how we play it.
Yeah, but, Finnegan jumped in, if we can do this quiet and stealthy, that's better, that's preferred. After that, the mercs peppered them with questions.
Number of refugees in the camp?
Finnegan shrugged.
Unknown. Transport.
Figured we'd use theirs.
What do we do when we have them?
A friend who has contacts in high places. He's actually the bank for this caper. Also the UN. He's going to have an escort waiting at the Serbian border to get us through.
And the Kosovar CO in Belgrade?
Fierro said.
He's ours. Everyone else worry about the rescue.
McTavish laughed.
A lark, then!
Chapter 40. The Hague, Netherlands. Director Milos Aleksic lived a few kilometers outside the government city, on a spit of land overlooking the North Sea. The house was an icon of 1970s architecture and looked more like an outdated notion of a flying saucer than an actual home. But the view was splendid. It was perched on a rocky outcropping, surrounded by a massive sloping lawn and a formidable stone wall on three sides, with the cliff and a sheer drop-off, and the North Sea on the fourth side. Curved floor-to-ceiling windows in the UFO building provided about 200 degrees of sea view from every room. And while it appeared to be a two-story building, lower floors and basements had been dug into the hard rock to both anchor the saucer-shaped top floors and to provide more space within. The lawn was rolling, a deep, unnatural green, and bisected by a winding driveway paved with crushed white shells that led to a five-car garage. As his car pulled up to the turnabout before the vast garage, Shan Grayson looked out at the house and its land and said, "Well, I'm here now." On the other end of his phone, Judge Ellen Betancourt made a tisk sound. "I'm not sanguine about this at all. It's going on midnight. I believe you spooked him when you spoke at the opera. He's fishing to find out what, if anything, you know. With a bit of luck, we'll soon know if Aleksic the Elder is aware that Aleksic the Twisted is a trafficker." "You know what I say about luck, Shan." He promised to be careful and rang off. As he reached for the door handle, Heinrich, his longtime driver, turned in his seat. "I'm with the judge. You yell if there's trouble." Shan knew that Heinrich carried a sidearm. "Trust me, you'll hear me shriek pathetically if I so much as smell a problem." He stepped out and jogged up the steps toward the curvature of the house, securing the middle button of his fitted black jacket. His white shirt was far too crisp for anyone making a midnight call. He had a shoe to tie. The director's wife, Maria, answered Shan's single knock.
Thomas Shannon Grayson," he smiled brightly. "Mrs. Aleksic, my deepest apologies for calling at this ungodly hour."
She whimpered.
"Oh, not at all, Mr. Grenville. My husband is a night owl. We visitors at all hours. Do please come in."
She escorted Shan to a sunken living room featuring a Japanese-inspired indoor garden with a bamboo waterfall and a stacked stone fireplace opposite the seaside windows. "There's an avocado-colored organic space in hell for modernist architects," Shan thought. The lights of oil derricks and cargo ships glistened on the horizon.
"Right in here. Please make yourself at home, Mr. Greenland. My husband is on a call to America. Won't be a moment. Would a drink be appropriate at this hour? I can brew tea, of course. You work for that judge, Madame Bonneville, yes? She seems to have it in for Serbians, I understand. Of course, such prejudices date back generations."
"Judge Betancourt holds the people of all nations in high regard," he smiled, correcting her name gently, not bothering with his own. "And I'll have a scotch, if that's at all possible."
"I would ask you to help yourself. The bar is just there. I shall let Milos know you're here, shall I? Please, please, sit anywhere."
She flitted about, adjusting a pillow here, straightening a curtain there. "Milos might be under the impression that the judge does not like the Balkan countries, Mr. Greyville. There is, perhaps, a bit of prejudice still to be found in Europe when it comes to the people of the former Yugoslavia. I hope that I do not offend." Shan had made no move toward the wet bar. "Not in the least. Judge Betancourt is quite fond of the former Yugoslavia. She welcomes the diversity that the region brings to the European Union."
"Pleased to hear it," the booming voice from the stairs startled him.
Milos Aleksic descended down a curved, open staircase, wearing a cardigan and driving moccasins with his pressed trousers and starched shirt. He'd helped himself to a clean shave, as evidenced by the pink sheen of his underchin and the whiff of menthol. He shot out a hand to shake. The silver hair over his ears exactly matched his pewter cufflinks. "Can one wear cufflinks with a cardigan?" Shan asked himself and quickly responded, "Indeed not."
"If you were walking in the direction of the scotch, kindly bring back two, will you?"
Aleksic turned to his wife and bent at the waist to buss her cheek. For a second, she reminded Shan of one of those stackable Russian dolls.
"Can't find my blue shirt, the one from Paris."
"I know where it is, dear," she toddled off.
Shan brought a heavy tumbler of good amber single malt to the director, who took it with a sideways smile.
"Damn good of you, Grayson. Shall we?"
He moved the conversation to a dark brown sofa. There is a rhythm to the conversation of diplomats. Those not adept in the art can get confused or bored, but Shan was very much the adept. So as he settled into the expensive leather couch, they spoke of the weather and of a recalcitrant American Congress. They spoke of by-elections in England and of the growing clout of the anti-Europe caucus and the Brexit of the UK from the EU. Shan let slip the fact that he recognized the hand of the tailor who'd crafted the suit Aleksic wore to the opera the other night. Aleksic laughed, and they told anecdotes of the crotchety, 90-year-old tailor who had once, it was said, hemmed the trousers of Hermann Göring. Miloš Aleksic eventually wended his way toward the subject of human trafficking, and his assumption that the learned judge knew fully well that the problem of abuse of refugees could be found across the board. Of the various routes now in play for the Middle Eastern flow of refugees, tales of the sex trade were rampant everywhere, as indeed they always had been. "It was true of displaced persons after World War II," Aleksic said. "It was true of displaced persons when the Iron Curtain rose. It was true during the Prague Spring and in Hungary in 1956. And of course it was true when my beloved Yugoslavia fell apart after the death of Tito." "Precisely," Shan said, "truly a terrible and universal truth. Someone will always exploit those most in need of the world's protection. It was ever thus." Aleksic nodded sagely and repeated the line, as if Shan had coined it himself. "It was ever thus. Exactly. May I?" He refilled their glasses from the wet bar. A North Sea squall began to block out the lights of tankers and oil platforms, the weather moving north or left to right from Shan's perspective. "How is your son?" Aleksic paused over the bottle and the fine, heavy glasses, if only for a second. "My son? Laurent, was it? We met at a fundraiser for, oh dear, don't remember. Oxfam? Possibly. He's an entrepreneur, I believe, businessman." Aleksic brought him his refreshed drink. "Lazar, actually. Yes, he works out of Zagreb, trucking. I adore Zagreb." "Cheers." They tinked glasses, and the older man sat again. "Funny you should mention him." "Hmm?" "Lazar. Funny you should mention him. He's had this idea for the refugees. He's collecting used dental equipment from the United States and Canada, getting it into the hands of refugee aid agencies in Turkey and Greece." "Really? Splendid idea. Apparently there's a dire need for dental hygiene for those escaping the wars. Anyway, Lazar saw a need and..." Aleksic waved his glass as if it were a wand. "Voila!" "Excellent. There are those who doubt Europeans have the entrepreneurial gene, but of course that's nonsense. Proof positive. Salut." "Salut." They spoke more, and in the meandering way of diplomats. The conversation was a bit like sailing a boat near, but not too near, a rocky shoal. Aleksic would dip close to the subject. Was Judge Betancourt prejudiced against the Slavic people, without being so gauche as to actually raise the question? And Shan, for his part, steered them toward the harrowing reports of underage trafficking coming out of Serbia, without, of course, ever pointing any accusing fingers. 40 minutes later, the men stood at the doorway to the Flying Saucer House and shook hands vigorously. "So good of you, and grateful for your insight, and pleasant journeys and all the rest. Big smiles, sage nods." Shan walked toward his car, smiling to himself. He thought it likely he had the answer the judge needed. He tapped the roof of the limo twice and slid into the back. "To Amsterdam, please." He pulled out his mobile and checked his emails and messages. No word from Catalin Fierro or Michael Finnegan, but then again they'd warned him they were about to go dark. He wondered if that meant they were moving against the younger Aleksic. He glanced up, noticing that the car hadn't moved. Heinrich hadn't even turned over the engine. He leaned forward. "Heinrich?" His driver leaned against the window. "Dead." Chapter 41. Kosovo. For radio communications, they decided on the following call signs. Fierro would be sweeper. Finnegan would be keeper. McTavish was defender. That left Bianchi as wingback, Lo Kwan as midfielder, and Facado as striker. Finnegan had to write it all down on the web of skin between his thumb and forefinger just to remember the silly call signs.
God knows, he tried to instill a little civilization to the group. Or we could go with point guard, shooting guard, high and low post, center. Yeah? Anyone? No? They blinked at him like he was speaking Etruscan. Fine, whatever. What's a sweeper? They drove from the farmhouse outside Sarajevo in the back of a boxy, top-heavy Renault Traffic, painted to resemble a laundry truck, which Bridget Sumner had scrounged up from her chaise lounge with a parasol overlooking the bright blue Met. Fierro took the wheel. She chose back roads, the provenance of which was provided by the same military satellite photos that Bridget had procured for KSF operating base Shar. They didn't rely on the GPS device in the truck, chucked it out the window, in fact, because if the truck fell into the wrong hands, a GPS device with its backed-up memory storage can become a liability. Fierro drove the laundry truck within 2 kilometers of Shar and parked it under a cluster of pine trees well back from prying eyes. The team checked their equipment. Everyone wore black fatigue pants and lace-up boots, plus black undershirts and light ballistic vests. They also wore radios clipped to the back of their vests with ear jacks and voice wands. Finnegan and Fierro carried their own handguns, a fifth-generation Glock 17 for him, chambered for 9mm bullets, which, for his money, was second to none in performance and durability. Fierro also preferred a 9mm, but she liked the Sig Sauer P226 tactical operations gun. Many women prefer a smaller gun for smaller hands, but Fierro had crewed racing yachts and had excelled in archery in college. Her wrists and hands were strong enough for the full-size weapon. To compensate for the size, she favored the lighter-weight anodized alloy frame. Fierro wore hers slung low to her long thigh because she'd trained as a kickboxer and disliked a holster that limited her ability to pivot and strike. A cop from a cop's family, Finnegan also carried a Halligan bar, a door-breaching tool that looked part pry bar, part hatchet, part tire iron. The thing could open virtually any door if you didn't mind leaving a smashed door frame in your wake. The 4 soldiers for hire favored the Browning Fabrique Nationale GP-35 handgun for its pure stopping power. Fierro, McTavish, and Bianchi carried Canadian-made C-8 assault carbines, the standard assault weapon for Fierro, and the heavier C-8 SWF for the guys, with its longer, heavier barrel and underslung grenade launcher. McTavish had been trained in the British Special Air Service, where he'd first been introduced to the C-8 and its curved 30-round box magazine. He adored his gun. He'd never given it a name, because to McTavish, that was a fetish only slightly less weird than guys who have a nickname for their penis. Beyond his Browning auto, chambered for .357 SIG ammunition, Lo Kwan also carried a wide array of knives and a small machete. He looked absurdly bulky under both a ballistic vest and the kind of fisherman's vest favored by photojournalists, his Velcro-secured pockets bulging with explosives, triggers, timers, and deck cord. Ficado, the distance shooter, strapped an Accuracy International AW-50 to his back. His kit included a long, state-of-the-art sound suppressor, and he chose subsonic rounds so he could shoot from afar with a minimum of noise. The AW-50 was as reliable as the traditional L96A1 sniper rifle, but designed to take out armored vehicles. With the use of an infrared scope, it could even eliminate targets inside bunkers by shooting straight through walls. The recoil was ferocious, but Ficado figured the rotator cuff damage was a price worth paying for a gun that could essentially kill a Buick. Geared up and carrying rucksacks, the 6 of them took off from the cluster of trees at 0100 hours. They hiked east through a field of barley, then up a craggy hill, down a steep and rocky slope, and up the next hillside. They did this 2 more times. At the top of the final hill, McTavish spotted a felled tree that would make good cover, and they hunkered down. The tree was backlit from the glow of KSF operating base Shar, less than 1 kilometer away. Lo Kwan pulled binoculars out of his backpack and scanned the scene.
Two guards at the gate, he whispered. Guard in the tower by that training field. Helipad, but no helicopter. Lights in the admin building. Lights in barracks 1, 2, and 3. No lights, barracks 4 and 5. Also, 1 armed guard outside barracks 3.
Finnegan said. The refugees. McTavish stuffed chewing tobacco into his cheek.
We play by Mighty Quinn rules.
Finnegan glanced at Fierro. She nestled close to him, her hair up in a French braid.
My
Fate Quinn. All without or all within. Either we do this quietly and kill nobody, or we shoot every target we see. He said, "The former's better." She said, "Sure," and turned to the mercenaries. She tapped Lo Kuan on the shoulder. "Can you take the guard in the tower quietly?" "Of course." She turned to Fekado. "If Lo Kuan can get you the tower, can you control the whole base?" The Ethiopian nodded. "Much of it." She nodded, turned to McTavish. "Midfielder and striker take the tower. Keeper goes for the motor pool." Finnegan checked the writing on his hand, thinking. "Oh, right, that's me. While you, me, and Wingback take Barrack 3, clear?" Brody McTavish spat tobacco into the roots of the felled tree. "Now that," he grinned, "sounds like a feckin' plan."